porterò in quel piccolo caffè per sentire una canzone con te. Jukebox, pochi soldi, una canzone, jukebox, un gettone, la felicità per sentire una canzone con te ed averti solamente per me. Il mio braccio ti darò e con me ti porterò in quel piccolo caffè per sentire una canzone con te.
Fred Buscaglione and his band with Jukebox. And that is it for this edition of Sunday Morning. Great to have had your company as always. I do hope you can join me this afternoon here on Radio 3 at 2 o'clock. That's for our coverage of the 2011 Royal Philharmonic Society Awards. But till then, goodbye.
Sunday Morning with Susie Klein is a perfectly normal production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Mark Schwarzentruber.
It's that whole... It's created by live music. Which I think is wonderful.
When it works, when it's a great performance, you certainly do feel a shared experience.
A live performance is totally, totally different.
A front row seat at a live concert every weekday night. Radio 3, live in concert.
To hear people coughing in the auditorium, to hear people applauding, enjoying the same piece together.
I do enjoy it through the radio.
Live concerts from across the UK. With, on Thursday, Lang Lang and Friends from the Royal Festival Hall. Radio 3, live in concert, weeknights from 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
And now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Mike Lee has made a quite unique contribution to theatre, television and film. Works like Abigail's Party, Nuts in May, Life is Sweet, Vera Drake, and currently at the Duchess Theatre in London, Ecstasy, reveal sections of society with extraordinary perception, great humour, and in the final analysis, I think, great love. Because in Ecstasy, for example, we see frailty, loneliness, and insecurity as the reason for both weakness and arrogance. Is that a fair description of that play?
I think that's right. I mean, what I try and do, and what we've certainly tried to do in Ecstasy, is to look at people, characters, absolutely three-dimensionally. That's what I always do, really. And that with that comes the complexity, the tension between, you know, that which is hilarious and that which is tragic, and all kinds of contradictory sorts of behaviour which manifests itself in everybody, including you and me, I should think.
Certainly. Yes. I was very struck by the quite extraordinary beauty of the voices. The central character, Jean, starts off by singing Danny Boy, and then the others all sing songs. And it was amazing. It was as though the voltage was turned up yet another notch by that.
Well, of course, one of the prerequisites was to make sure that I had actors who could sing, and lots of actors can. But in terms of the actual use of music dramatically, outside of the question of musicals or opera or comic opera or whatever, in my own so-called, as it were, straight drama, it's always very exciting when people, and very often ordinary people, produce music. And the music obviously has a dual function. It operates evocatively in its own right as music, but of course it is very much a function of character, and it's about the person in question. And I think that's what you're experiencing next with it. I mean, it is just a sing-song, but it takes us to another place. And when, I mean, you've seen Sean Brooke playing Jean in Ecstasy, and when she sings Danny Boy, it gets me every time, and I obviously am very familiar with the production.
But also I suspect you believe that one has to earn the right for a moment of music. So it's not just sort of plastered on like wallpaper, that actually is very integral, like silence.
Absolutely. For example, if in the second act of Ecstasy it was lights up and they were all singing, it would have no meaning whatever. In fact, it would be embarrassing and mawkish and generally bad news. But Nuts in May, Bleak Moments, The Man on the Guitar, Topsy Turvy, of course, is a film about making music, amongst many other things. And there again, we had actors who absolutely could and do sing.
Did you love Gilbert and Sullivan from way back?
Yes. The minute you start talking about Gilbert and Sullivan, the one thing I have to say immediately is that I've got no time for apologists or cynics about Gilbert and Sullivan. It's great. It's good fun. It's great music. It's incredibly well written. And when performed properly, that's to say not in a kind of awful camp and sort of superficial, embarrassing, mawkish way that some people may remember and associate with horrible schoolmasters or maiden aunts or something, it is actually a gas, and I love it.
So what are we going to hear then?
Well, we've got two bits of Gilbert and Sullivan here, and the reason for that is that they are very funny, Gilbert and Sullivan, and I've chosen a piece from Ruddy Gore, which is the two sort of ex-renegades who are now terribly reformed, singing and indeed dancing and celebrating their new reformed status. And then we're going to hear a piece from Princess Ida, The World Is But a Broken Toy, which I've chosen because it's the other side of Gilbert and Sullivan. It's joyous, it's melodious, it's beautiful. It's a great piece of writing, particularly musically. And I thought, you know, just to have a very comic piece and Gilbert and Sullivan at their most lyrical would be a good combination.
Well, we'll start with I Was Once a Very Abandoned Person.
Was a very abandoned person,
making the most of evil chances.
Nobody could conceive a worse,
even in all the old romances.
I blush for my wild extravagances, but be so kind to bear in mind,
we were the victims of circumstances. One of our blameless dancers. I was once an exceedingly odd young lady,
suffering much from spleen and vipers.
Clergyman thought my conduct shady.
She didn't spend much upon linen drapers.
It certainly entertained the gapers. My ways were strange beyond all range.
Paragraphs got into all the papers. We only cut respectable capers. I've given up all my wild proceedings.
My taste for a wandering life is waning.
Now I'm a dab at penny readings.
They are not remarkably entertaining.
A moderate livelihood we're gaining.
In fact, we rule a national school.
The duties are dull, but I'm not complaining.
sort of thing takes a deal of training.
It's a wonderful synthesis of character, situation, words, and the way Sullivan sets it, on the face of it, you say this is very kind of regular, but the texture and the sort of wit within the structure of the thing is fantastic, really.
I was once a very abandoned person from Ruddy Gore Act 2 by Gilbert and Sullivan, Richard Watson, Sir Despard, and Anne Drummond Grant, Mad Margaret. Presumably in Topsy Turvy, you actually had to make a decision whether the people that you were working with could play and could sing.
Everybody that sings in Topsy Turvy really is singing. All the actors that play instruments really can play. I mean, we had wonderful fun with the auditions. There are loads of actors out there who are very good actors who can really sing, and those are the guys that we recruited. I mean, any number of people came and sang for us, and they all had to sing a bit of Gilbert and Sullivan, and many of them have never heard of Gilbert and Sullivan. But they really are doing it. And of course, Alan Corduna, who plays Sullivan, is himself a consummate pianist. I don't quite know who else we'd have got to play Sullivan if we hadn't got him, because he's a great actor, perfect for Sullivan, and he really is a musician. So that was very good news indeed.
Well, now we move on to then The World Is But a Broken Toy, your second choice, which is the other side, if you like.
I was tempted to bring on the programme something from Sullivan's other repertoire, but we don't want to spend too much time
in that corner of the world.
Yeah. But I just think this is very gorgeous in its way.
The World Is But a Broken Toy from Princess Ida, Act 2, by Gilbert and Sullivan. Victoria Sladen was Princess Ida, Thomas Round, Hilarion, Leonard Osborne, Cyril, Geoffrey Skitch, Florian, with the D'Oyly Carte Opera and Orchestra conducted by Isidore Godfrey. Mike Lee, I was wondering whether you found it very difficult to compile this list of pieces.
I did. It was enormously difficult because I've got, I suppose, pretty wide-ranging and quite eclectic tastes within certain parameters, and you'd never wind up thinking this is a kind of representative, because it can't be representative. I mean, we go now from Gilbert and Sullivan to opera, and I very much enjoy opera at all sorts of levels. We've got a bit of Così fan tutte next, which in some way follows on from the bit of Princess Ida we've just heard. I couldn't decide whether to go to Weber or Donizetti or Rossini, or indeed to the greater operas. So,
but in a way, Mozart, perhaps in particular, does rather what you do. He looks at society with a slightly satirical eye. He points up the rather absurd things we all get up to as human beings.
I think that's absolutely right, and Così fan tutte is right at the centre of that. You know, occasionally I get asked, how about directing an opera? Well, because I don't do, I only make things up. It's not really an issue, although it might be fun. But that would be one of the most obvious pieces to look at. It is a wonderful comic, real, ironic, and rich human piece. And it does resonate with me, I guess.
And this trio is stunningly beautiful, isn't it?
It is. I used it, incidentally, in my film High Hopes quite a long time ago, in that awful scene when the posh lady next door takes the old working-class lady, brings her in because she's lost her key, and then bullies her about moving out so that the place can be gentrified. And she has this on her tape deck in the kitchen while she went during the scene. And indeed, it's a piece that's been used either evocatively or indeed ironically in quite a number of films. It is beautiful and, of course, ironic.
Thank you.
See, that's under 3 minutes.
I'm just going to say.
But what a long journey we've been on. I mean, the transition of mood. And of course, it fascinates me as a dramatist and a filmmaker, you know, the ability to take us from place to place through such extremes with such finesse and delicacy and so imperceptibly. It's wonderful.
And harmonically innovative as well, because there's that moment when, you know, we both look at each other where he sort of plunges the harmony into an unexpected area.
Well, that's exactly what I mean. And when that happens, I mean, we're sitting in this room together and we both sort of had a sort of slightly orgasmic moment, you know. It's very good. It's wonderful. Yeah.
We heard Hilary Martin-Pelto singing Fiordaligi, Alison Hagley, Dora Bella, Thomas Allen, Don Alfonso, with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, conducted by Simon Rattle in Suave sia il vento from Così fan tutte, Act 1, by Mozart. I wonder whether, as a dramatist yourself, Mike, you're ever slightly envious of the ability that opera has to articulate different ideas simultaneously at the same time.
I'm not. Because that's what one tries to do anyhow, really.
No, but you know, but it is rather a remarkable thing about opera. What makes opera unique, anyway?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, it takes us to another level and it gets to the essence of things. But you see, I'm not frustrated by not being able to do what opera does. I mean, that's not, obviously, you're not serious, I guess. But I mean, what that does relate to is the kind of debate that starts with people say, oh, well, Mike Leigh's work is naturalistic. It's mundane and all those things, which, of course, it isn't naturalistic. I'm concerned with realism and not naturalism. I'm concerned with getting to the essence of things. And I'm concerned absolutely with creating a kind of distilled, heightened world which reads and we experience, you, the audience, experience as being completely believable and three-dimensional. But in fact, you are taken onto different levels and, you know, there are different things going on, both in surface terms and deeply embedded in the subtext. So I think the important thing about opera is not so much what's there to be frustrated about, but what's there to be inspired by. And in a way, one aspires to the condition of opera within the convention of film and theatre realism.
The next one brings us another comic opera, in fact.
Yes, this brings us to the Tales of Offenbach, and I've chosen the Clockwork Doll song. Again, this is something that I've used, because in the brothel scene in Topsy Turvy, we discovered that there were these little lesbian tableaus went on, and I was very keen to work a bit of Offenbach into the film, if I could, just as we've worked a bit of Weber and some other composers in. And we have this wonderful pianist played by Gary Urshan, the composer, with a funny wig on and a shrill falsetto, singing this whilst there are a couple of women prostitutes are doing a kind of suggestive piece of choreography. Wonderful stuff. And Offenbach is just so succulent. So apart from anything I'm saying, let us just enjoy it. Thank you. mean, apart from anything else, what I love about that is that you can taste 19th century Paris. You know, you can smell it. You can taste the oysters, you know. It's wonderful.
Les oiseaux dans la chemise, the song of the doll from the Tales of Hoffmann, Act II by Offenbach. Gianna D'Angelo singing Olympia with the Orchestre de la Société des Concerts du Conservatoire, conducted by André Cruytens. It doesn't surprise me, Mike, given the pointed nature, the provocative nature of a lot of your work, that you should be interested in Weill and Brecht.
The scope of Weill and Brecht, when we look at it in the context of their original work in Germany before they left in the Weimar period, is extraordinary. I've chosen Mack the Knife in the original 1928 recording sung by Harald Paulsen, because it's so evocative, and you just sense the real hard, threatening, arrogant, defiant, healthy blade, a sharp blade of the satyr.
Sharp of the knife,
yeah.
Und der Hai Fisch, der hat Zähne, und die trägt im Gesicht. Und Mekister hat sein Messer, doch das Messer sieht man nicht. An einem schönen blauen Sonntag liegt ein toter Mann am Strand, und ein Mensch geht um die Ecke, den man Mäcki-Messer nennt. Und Schmulmeier bleibt verschwunden, und so mancher reiche Mann. Und sein Geld hat Mäcki-Messer, dem man nichts beweisen kann. Jenny Tauler war gefunden mit einem Messer in der Brust, und am Kai geht Mäcki Messer, der von allem nichts gewusst. Und das große Feuer in Soho, sieben Kinder und ein Greis, in der Menge Mäcki Messer, den man nichts fragt und er nicht weiß. Und die Minder der Gewitwe, deren Namen jeder weiß, wachte auf und war geschändet. Mäcki, welches war dein Preis? Wachte auf und war geschändet. Mäcki, welches war dein Preis?
Actually, what I wanted to say about that piece is that it's interesting to compare it with the comic song from Gilbert and Sullivan that we started with, because like Sullivan, listen to the way Kurt Weill develops the piece and varies it within the verses and grows it.
Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht's Ballad of Mack the Knife from the Threepenny Opera. We heard Harald Paulsen singing Mack the Knife, and unfortunately, since that was a 1928 recording, we cannot credit the orchestra and conductor. They've sunk into the mists of time. What I love about this programme when I'm talking to somebody who has got a rather unusual take on things is that they bring something which most of us don't know. I may have heard this once before, but I certainly don't know it well.
Well, we're with Shostakovich. Yeah. We're familiar with his film music. I mean, he composed the scores, for example, for Cosin Seff's Hamlet and King Lear later. This is a film called Alone, or apparently in Russian, Adna, which you approach it with healthy ambivalence, because it's a very propagandist piece. It was made both as a silent film and a talkie, because it was made in 1929, 30, 31. And it's great music. As a filmmaker, I mean, one of the things that perhaps is worth sharing is that one of the best bits of filmmaking is working with a composer, because the film is done and then you sort of...
It's always the last thing, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I've worked with, I mean, Gary Ershon, Andrew Dixon, Carl Davis, Rachel Portman. I like to work with composers who are classical based fundamentally, although that's not quite true of Andrew Dixon, but certainly live instruments. And the one of the best bits in my life is when you go into the recording, the music recording session, and the guys who have no idea what they're going to play just walk in and they pick up their instruments and they play it as if they did all their lives, and it brings the film to life. So this is fascinating to me, this piece of Shostakovich. It precedes his famous jazz stuff, which was from the late 30s, and it covers an extraordinarily wide range within this very, not only narrow remit, because it was very, very propagandist piece about a girl going to the big city and finding her way, but it's very succulent.
Техникум, кончена учеба, я живу наверху большого небоскреба. В небоскребе этом целых пять этажей, в каждом этаже магазин. Ты же барышком чищу зубы, гребешком причешу и без помады свежи губы. Два доклада предстоит еще мне сдать, прочитать снова заново Пехонова. 40-18 том. Дом, все кругом дом, а в доме том всем известный факт прошивает шахт. Шахт, ряды голосов. Шахт очень хорошо.
Music from Shostakovich's score for the film Alone, the music restored by Mark Fitzgerald, who conducted the Frankfurt Radio Symphony Orchestra, and the soprano was Irina Matayeva. Now, Georges Delarue, famous French film composer.
Absolutely. Here we are with that wonderful song. Again, we're talking about characters going on to another level by actually singing, and Jeanne Moreau playing Catherine in Jules et Jim, Le Tourbillon de la Vie. It's a great moment. And of course, for those of us of a certain age, this takes us back to when we saw this movie and all the guys irrespective of their orientation, were all passionately in love with Jeanne Moreau. And, of course, we still are.
Elle avait des bagues à chaque doigt, des tas de bracelets autour des poignets, et puis elle chantait avec une voix qui sitôt m'enjola. Elle avait des yeux d'opale, qui me fascinaient. Il y avait l'ovale de son visage pâle, de femme fatale qui me fut fatale, de femme fatale qui me fut fatale. On s'est connu, on s'est reconnu, on s'est perdu de vue, on s'est reperdu de vue, on s'est retrouvé, on s'est réchauffé, puis on s'est séparé. Chacun pour soi est reparti dans le tourbillon de la vie. Je l'ai revu un soir, aïe aïe aïe, ça fait déjà un fameux bail, ça fait déjà un fameux bail. Au son des banjos, je l'ai reconnu, ce curieux sourire qui m'avait tant plu, sa voix si fatale, son beau visage pâle, mais mûr plus que jamais. Je me suis saoulée en l'écoutant, l'alcool fait oublier le temps. Je me suis réveillée en sentant des baisers sur mon front brûlant, des baisers sur mon front brûlant. On s'est connu, on s'est reconnu, on s'est perdu de vue, on s'est reperdu de vue, on s'est retrouvé, on s'est séparé, puis on s'est réchauffé. Chacun pour soi est reparti dans le tourbillon de la vie. Je l'ai revue un soir, ah là là, elle est retombée dans mes bras, elle est retombée dans mes bras. Quand on s'est connu, quand on s'est reconnu, pourquoi se perdre de vue, se reperdre de vue? Quand on s'est retrouvé, quand on s'est réchauffé, pourquoi se séparer? Alors tous deux, on est repartis dans le tourbillon de la vie. On a continué à tourner, tous les deux enlacés, tous les deux enlacés, tous les deux enlacés.
It's great. And of course it comes from a great film by Truffaut, which was an inspiration to all of us.
Le tourbillon de la vie from Jules Jean by Georges Delarue, sung by Jeanne Moreau. Well, the next music that we're going to come to, rightly, I think, gives us an opportunity to talk about your much written about ways of working, because it's improvisatory. And people always talk about the way you get something on to the stage or even into film with a degree of improvisation, although that perhaps belies the precision that has gone into the initial work.
Well, certainly the precision is what we wind up with, and everything you ever see on the screen or the stage in my pieces has evolved from improvisation. Very occasionally in the films there are actually passages of improvisation on camera. I don't like that very much. It's not interesting. One wants to arrive at something that is distilled and precise and meaningful. There are occasions, for example, in Happy-Go-Lucky, the stuff with the kid is improvised, mostly because you wouldn't want to subject a kid to sophisticated rehearsal techniques and stuff. But on the whole, it's not about taking improvisation as a thing in itself. It's not about exalting improvisation in its own right. It's doing what, in fact, all artists do. Whether you paint or write, you improvise, you interact with the material, and then you rework that and distill it into the finished article.
So with a play like Ecstasy, sorry to interrupt, the actors would know their lines absolutely
totally,
before
totally,
you start working.
Well, no, they wouldn't know their lines. I mean, in the revival that we've just done, of course, they didn't learn their lines before we started the rehearsal, so that would be inorganic and not healthy. The thing has to evolve in a way that where action and word and text and subtext are all worked out and grown in an organic way.
But the lines are there.
But the lines are there, yes. I mean, the script is there. And in the original production, we arrived at something very precise. So, I mean, in fact, whereas you can have a bit of improvisation if you want it on film, and lots of films and filmmakers can do that, and I have a little bit, as I say, very occasionally. You cannot put a stage play in front of an audience and have anything that is going to be improvised on the night. That is meaningless. It will be a shambles and an embarrassment, and I don't quite know how it would work.
But I suppose the great key is that it looks improvised.
Well, page one is that, as I understand it, you're supposed to think that this is really happening, because that's what it's all about. And therefore, my life's journey has been to try and tackle the problem of making it seem absolutely real, which, I hate to say it, but many a play, and indeed many a film, don't. That's the job.
So, having said that, what is your take on the kind of improvisation we're about to hear?
Well, here we are with Miles Davis, Kind of Blue. This is actually Blue in Green, one of the tracks. Here's a quintet of well-known players led by Miles Davis and with John Coltrane and Bill Evans and the guys. And they are, it's a famous improvised session. And in fact, Miles apparently laid down the premise hardly more than an hour or two before they actually went into the recording session. But what's important is that this isn't a sort of random collection of people who've never met, just successfully improvised. This is an ensemble. These are guys who know each other, understand each other, who are on the same page, who are communing and sensitively communicating and who have a collective intuition. And when we listen to it, it is as perfect as any other piece of music you could imagine, but it is a famous jam session.
Thank you.
I was thinking while we were listening to it that, well, we rather waffled on about improvising and stuff. And it is extraordinary that that is just such an exercise. But it is so perfect and so moving. And there's such a depth of passion and humanity that just is distilled again into that remarkable magic,
I mean, I think slightly, especially since they presumably they have chord sequences that they know they're going to follow, but nevertheless, it allows for the unexpected.
Totally. Totally.
We heard Blue in Green from Kind of Blue, Miles Davis Quintet, with John Coltrane playing tenor, Bill Evans piano, Paul Chambers bass, and Jimmy Cobb drums. Pretty good lineup by any standards. Now, you used some Beethoven once, didn't you, for a famous heart attack.
Yes, poor old Lawrence in Abigail's Party puts on Beethoven's fifth, a last-ditch attempt to inflict culture on his guests, and then he kicks the bucket of a heart attack, which is perhaps why we're not going to listen to Beethoven's fifth now. But, Beethoven plays a big part in my listening, and I've chosen the Violin Concerto. It's just enervating stuff.
Thank you.
Music from Beethoven's Violin Concerto in D, Opus 61, the third movement, Rondo. We heard Itzhak Perlman playing the violin with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Carlo Maria Giulini. What are you working on at the moment, Michael? A play? Or?
I'm going to do another play at the National Theatre, we're going to create, which opens in September. And don't ask me what it's about, because I could hardly tell you. We'll find out. It'll be a journey of discovery, as usual. And then we're going to do much what we did with Topsy Turvy, hopefully, if we can get the money together, which we're trying desperately to do, which is to make a major feature about Turner, the painter. And that's as much as I can say about that. But that is the next film scheme.
Well, Mike Lee, thank you for countless hours of pleasure with your writing and your directing, and for sharing your musical private passions with us.
Thank you, Michael. It's been great.
Mike Lee was talking to Michael Barclay. Well, next Sunday at the same time, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the choreographer Kathy Marston. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3, and today's edition was produced by Chris Marshall.
They're some of the most prestigious prizes in music. The annual Music Awards of the Royal Philharmonic Society celebrate the music industry's most distinguished practitioners, whether composers, musicians, writers, broadcasters, or inspirational arts organisations. In this week's Sunday concert, Susie Klein will bring you some of the highlights of this year's ceremony at the Dorchester and speak to some of the winners. The RPS Music Awards, in the Sunday concert from 2 o'clock.
Well, that's here on BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. It's a couple of minutes after 1 o'clock, time for the news with David Cornett.
The head of the International Monetary Fund, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, is due in court in New York later today, charged with attempted rape and unlawful imprisonment. He's accused of attacking a maid in his room at a hotel in Manhattan. His lawyer said Mr. Strauss-Kahn, who's a possible French socialist presidential candidate, would deny all the charges. There's been a series of clashes between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian protesters marking the anniversary of the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. Troops have fired rubber bullets and tear gas at a large crowd marching towards the border in Gaza. At least 15 people are said to have been wounded. There are also reports that shots were fired as Palestinian refugees from Syria tried to breach the Israeli border in the Golan Heights. The head of Britain's armed forces has said NATO must step up the military campaign in Libya. In an interview with the Sunday Telegraph, General Sir David Richards said the country's infrastructure should be targeted to prevent Colonel Gaddafi remaining in power. Essex police say they'll decide this week whether or not to investigate claims that the Liberal Democrat Energy Secretary, Chris Huhne, asked another person to take penalty points on his behalf for a speeding offence. Police confirmed that they'd received a complaint from a Labour MP and said they would examine the case before making a decision. Mr. Huhne denied the claims when they were printed in newspapers last weekend. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, has said she'll reverse the rejection of the process whereby the House of Lords directly elect police commissioners for England and Wales. She blamed the rejection on what she called sheer opportunism from Labour. The Irish Prime Minister, Enda Kenny, has said he's confident that adequate security arrangements have been put in place for the Queen's visit later this week. A 10,000-strong force is being deployed amid threats from dissident Republicans. And the weather, there'll be a brisk westerly wind and outbreaks of mainly light rain, which will affect much of the north and west, especially western Scotland. Southern Britain will stay mainly dry but cloudy. BBC News and Weather at 4 minutes past one.
Read by David Cornett. I'm Jill Anderson. Very good afternoon to you. At 4 o'clock, there's another chance to hear Wednesday's Choral Evensong service, which came from the London Festival of Contemporary Church Music at St Pancras Church. We'll hear music by Andrew Simpson, Leon Charles, Gregory Rose, Anthony Pitts and Thomas Hyde. And that's all at 4 o'clock this afternoon. But now it's time for the Early Music Show with Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to the show, and highlights today from two concerts of Baroque music given last summer at the Torroella di Mongri International Music Festival. Originally, this town in the northeast corner of Spain was the royal port for the kings of Aragon. And it still has a distinctly medieval feel, with narrow cobble streets, a colonnaded square, and the impressive 14th century Gothic church of San Genis, where many of the concerts take place. The performers we're going to hear are the Italian-based group Accademia Bizantina. They begin with a double concerto by Vivaldi, and rather strange in texture it is too. Well, I think so, because the two soloists in question are a violin and an organ. So perhaps a slightly uneven match, but a good piece all the same, particularly the slow second movement, which dispenses with the orchestra altogether, leaving just the organ to accompany the violin. It's back to Tutti, though, for the bouncy allegro, which contains all the sparkle you'd expect from a Vivaldi concerto.